I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is My Wardrobe Malfunction, the podcast about our relationship with clothes, life, and pretty much everything else. This is the final episode of season 6. Welcome back to old friends, and hello to new ones. If you haven't heard us before, listen back to our other wonderful guests, including Donna Eyre talking about coat hangers, Ashley Roberts on Goldie Hawn, and David Baddiel on, oh my goodness, posing chairs. But let's get on to today's guest. She's a broadcasting legend and pioneer, journalist, tireless campaigner, founder of Childline and the Silver Line, patron or vice president of more than 55 charities, and now podcaster of That's Afterlife. She's none other than Dame Esther Ranson and has long been a hero of mine. So to tell you the truth, I was a bit bloody nervous. This episode is another of our two-parters. The second part drops on Sunday. So let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors, and find out what's inside. Today, I am joined by one of my heroes, and I don't say that lightly, and I'm with Dame Esther Ranson, broadcasting legend and pioneer, journalist, tireless campaigner, founder of Childline and Silverline, and patron or vice president of over 55 charities. How have you managed to do all this, Esther?
Well, if you have a look at it, most of what you just described has been done by other people. That is my secret. Delegate. Because if you have a look at, for example, Childline, which has helped around 5 million kids since we launched in 86. Now, I didn't do that, did I? You know, I'm totally wonderful and omnipotent and all those things. I'm amused by what you call me because I've had so many labels. I started with toothy. I ended up with veteran, which makes me sound like an old banger, you know, one of those old cars. Anyway, 5 million children have been helped by generations of professionals and volunteers, all passionately committed, all skilled and talented and generous and compassionate and empathetic. So I just sit here every now and then taking credit for their work. And it's the same with everything you describe, those charities are all being run by other people. And it's the same with my television work. You know, you can't do television on your own. The amount of stuff you can do on your own is fairly limited and probably self-indulgent.
But they were your initiatives. So it was, you know, you found, for want of a better term, a gap in the market, an area that was lacking. And it was... And I think Childline is probably one of the most important organisations to have been set up in this country, and then Silverline.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? I think it's because my training in journalism has all been solution-focused. You know, people came to us for 21 years on That's Life with problems. And among the questions we asked was why? Why did this happen? And how could it have been prevented? Maybe how should it have been prevented? And that led me to try and look for answers. And when I couldn't find an answer to the secret crime that was child abuse, where only the perpetrator and the child knew it was happening, the idea of a helpline, well, it came out of a helpline that when we were discussing child abuse on That's Life, we opened a helpline, as we often did with problems that we were investigating on That's Life, which you're too young to remember. But
no, I'm so not too young to remember.
It's odd to think that it was launched in 73 and came off the air in 94. So that means 94, 2004, 2014. Nearly 30 years ago it came off the air. Anyway, we opened this helpline after one edition of That's Life. And because children who couldn't, dare not talk about their suffering any other way rang up the number and talked to us, I realized that the phone has ways of reaching people safely so that they feel they can be confidential that no other medium has. And I think that's still true. I think the Silver Line has shown that too.
The Silver Line came about from your own experience, wasn't it, of feeling after your beloved husband, Desmond, passed away and the loneliness that that brings, and you quite rightly and empathetically realise there are so many people going through that, and that's why you set up Silver Line.
Yes, well, I wrote about it. A friend of mine who lived on his own, alas, has passed away. Bless him, John Pittman, my friend and colleague on Braden's Week, started out together. Mm. When he read it, he said, "How could you write like that, Esther? Haven't you too much pride?" Because there's a real stigma about talking about loneliness. Also, you know, as we found from the Silver Line, when people ring us, the two words they bring to us, the two B words I call them, are burden. I don't want to be a burden, so I don't want to tell my family and friends how I feel. And busy. The world's so busy, my daughter's so busy, my son-in-law's so busy, et cetera, et cetera. So it is interesting that the phone is once again a way that people who feel that they can't unburden their feelings or their experiences face-to-face with people can do it confidentially if they know that their confidentiality is going to be respected, as Childline does and as the Silver Line does. Mm. A lot of the face-to-face services have found it impossible due to COVID.
Yeah.
But if the way you reach out to people is via the phone, fortunately, this does not spread infections, this little telephone.
Yeah.
So we're still able to do it. Our problem is that certainly with Childline, we're down to half our normal number of volunteers because so many of them are 70 plus and shielding. And so many of them have got other problems in their lives, like they're ill or they've got someone close to them ill. So Childline really, really needs volunteers. And anybody who's listening to this who has 4 hours a week to spare, they go on to our website. You can see how to apply because we'd love to have you.
Well, you know what? I'm going to do that when I finish this. I'm going to apply because I think it's absolutely fundamentally important, and I'm going to apply. Is there a certain age? Do you have to be over a certain age, over 18 or something, to do it?
We take 16-year-olds. I was quite concerned about that because I thought, you know, listening to some of the stories that you obviously listen to from children who are being abused or neglected might be a problem. But I was roundly informed that not all 16-year-olds are the same. And when I met them, I realised that I was wrong. But the people that we have to persuade are in Age UK because they've got an 18-plus rule. And the Silver Line has just become part of Age UK. So I'm hoping that they will learn from Childline's example because, of course, intergenerationally, 16-year-olds and...
Fantastic.
Yeah. Works like a dream. There's no reason not to.
So you've had your jab, haven't you, after spending 10 months in isolation with your daughter, Miriam. And obviously with, you know, loneliness has affected very many people last year, this year and last year. Do you now feel, thank goodness, finally people understand Silver Line's mission? Do you think it's brought it to a head?
I think when we started our lockdown last March, quite a lot of the callers I spoke to said, well, now they know, don't they? Because you know, they've been suffering this isolation themselves for months, maybe years. And the world didn't really recognise how painful and difficult it can be. But I can't say the jab has made any difference to me at all, because my view is not that I don't trust one jab, which is all I've had. I do. I trust, you know, those brilliant scientists who've done all the rigorous testing, not necessarily working for Pfizer, but working independently and have found that you get 89% protection after 3 weeks. But that still leaves 11 people who may actually go down with this horrible illness. And the last thing I want to do is be one of those 11 in ICU taking up valuable space and resources. Mm-hmm. So I'm still isolating, still shielding, still not cuddling my children and grandchildren until such time as the numbers have really fallen. Mm. I'm confident that whoever the 11 are, I'm not necessarily going to meet them.
This is sort of going off on a tangent, but what I found extraordinary is how we've all adapted so quickly, and especially the younger generation. I mean, I look at my children who are sort of 22 to 17, and the way they're managing, I have so much respect for them and how they're finding ways of keeping themselves entertained, not on social media or, you know, picking up a laptop or something, and how they've adapted to homeschooling. And I just find the younger generation generally have been absolutely incredible. And I don't know if you found that with your grandchildren. I'm not sure how old they are.
Mine are younger.
Okay.
8, 5 and 3. And I think they miss their friends terribly.
Yeah.
I was talking to a five-year-old and a seven-year-old yesterday via this interesting medium. And which doesn't really work very well with them because they have a whole day of Zoom homeschooling. So the last thing they want is to carry on in their own time. But they do miss their friends. But I'm quite interested in homeschooling because I've noticed that some of the most original and interesting minds have been homeschooled.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I was not that I have an interesting brilliant mind, but I was homeschooled until I was 13. I think it kind of teaches you respect in a strange way because you're, I mean, I spent so much time alone and I kind of drew from nature and my surroundings, and it made me kind of appreciate all the things around me, as well as getting sort of some basic form of education. But you become resilient and self-reliant, I think, more so.
Everything depends on your home, doesn't it? I mean, if you're locked away in some dreadful, violent, unsafe environment, then of course you suffer. And for a lot of children in that situation, school is their one refuge.
Yeah.
So we have to be careful. But it's always struck me, you know, Shakespeare has never been bettered. His understanding of human nature, his use of language, his classical education comes through in everything he's written. It's absolutely, obviously, we know he's a genius, but he's never been bettered. And he was writing at the turn of the 16th century. So in all the hundreds of years in which we've assembled so much factual knowledge, so much more understanding of the universe around us, we haven't got better playwrights, have we? No. So what does that say about our education? It's very good in a linear way. I'm not knocking it, but is it as good as the education Shakespeare had?
Life. Is life the best form of education? And you look at someone like Dickens. I mean, I do think Dickens is almost on a par with Shakespeare in terms of his understanding of human nature and being able to, I mean, he had such emotional intelligence, I think, Dickens. And with the characters he drew and immersing himself so obviously in the people around him and society on all levels.
I agree. Set aside the way he treated his wife, you know, not all great artists are saints, but set that aside, he was, of course, a journalist.
Yeah.
And meant that he had a very inquiring mind. I'm fascinated by his relationship with the Coutts heiress. Because she set up, it's worth Googling her.
Okay.
Because she set up major charities, including the NSPCC and the RSPCA and others. And Dickens alerted her to good causes so that she could use
them. Really? Yeah. Oh my goodness. That's fantastic. So anyway, we've gone off on a lovely wild tangent, which normally happens. But I read that you were born in Hertfordshire, But you grew up in New York till you were 10.
Only 2 years, from 10 till 12. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Hertfordshire till I was 5 and the war ended, then moved to Hampstead, which was the family home, and have more or less lived in Hampstead ever since, apart from the 2 years I spent in Long Island, New York, which gave me a deep love of America. I loved it. Very happy there. And then 3 years at Oxford, but the rest of the time, until COVID struck, and now I'm a country woman. I'm in the New Forest.
Heaven, heaven. But don't you feel such gratitude for being in the countryside at the moment, being able to get out and breathe the fresh air?
I do not take it for granted, absolutely. I mean, my daughter and I, she can only walk for about 10 minutes, but every day we walk about 10 minutes. She's got ME. Mm.
Okay.
And once again, people with long COVID are beginning to understand how disabling ME is. And she and I are hoping that one of the few positives that have come out of this horrible pandemic may be people doing more research into the impact of viruses, because ME tends to have been kicked off by a virus in the same way and had an extraordinary impact on your capacity to live a normal life. I mean, she had to give up work. You know, she's and the awful thing is she's not entitled to benefit, because so many people question whether ME is indeed the chronic illness we know it to be.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, Esther, you performed with the Oxford University Dramatic Society and became Secretary of Experimental Theatre. Were you very confident in your kind of late teens, early 20s?
Yes and no. I was quite overweight. And what that did was it made me rely on entertaining people, because I knew that I was not attractive the way some of my sophisticated friends were, with tiny waists. And you know, this was the 50s we're talking about, so late 50s, so big swirly skirts and, you know, Marilyn Monroe shape. Not to me. I was more barrel shaped, I think I was. Anyway, so making people laugh was important. And actually, quite a lot of people find laughter as a way to defend yourself against bullies, because it's very hard to bully somebody who's making you laugh and making the crowd laugh, sometimes at your expense. And because I did quite a lot of that, by the time I got to Oxford, I knew I was not good enough to be a professional actor in any way. So I thought, well, this is my last fling. I've got to do as much as I can, because I'll never be able to do it again. So I joined all the theatrical stuff. And in those days, it was quite interesting. I have rationed myself the number of times I say in those days, so you can count them if I say it again. In those days, the previous year was the last year who had done national service. So they came to university at the age of 22-ish, already with grown-up ambitions. They weren't kids anymore. National service was quite traumatic for a number of them, because the British Army wasn't always well behaved. But anyway, when it came to university drama, they were very grown up indeed. And we used to get critics from national papers looking at the student productions. I got my first appalling review from either the Times or the Telegraph. And we went up to the Edinburgh Festival, and gave rise to people like Beyond the Fringe, Dudley Moore, Alan Bennett, were just ahead of me at Oxford. I remember Alan Bennett coming to our where the Oxford Theatre Group was staying during the Edinburgh Festival, and he was sitting on the stairs and he said, "Oh, it'll never do, you know, it'll never do." And he thought it was going to be such a failure because people weren't getting on particularly well in the team. Jonathan Mittler, Peter Cook, Alan Bennett, Dudley Moore. That we thought we'd better go to the first night to help them out with a few, you know, rounds of applause. And when we got there, the place was absolutely rammed to the ceiling and people were shrieking with laughter and applauding everything. And it took off and it went straight to the West End and from there to Broadway and the rest is history. But that was why I did it. I did it because I'd done it at school and I thought this was my last opportunity.
Now, clothes, did you have any interest in them when you were growing up?
Clothes?
Yeah, any, or did you have any icons or people who inspired you, your mum?
I had a very elegant aunt. My mum was rather well-dressed too. But being overweight, clothes don't endear themselves to you at all, you know?
No.
The only time I got interested in clothes was when I started to appear on television and I got someone who was trying to sort out my terrible taste. If it sparkles, I tend to be attracted to it. I remember one series of That's Life. Critics said I looked like turkey dressed up in foil, ready for Christmas, and I did too.
To go in the oven.
So I learned a lot professionally, but I have now regressed. I now live in one of three onesies. As I sit here talking to you, I'm in my pink onesie, I've got a blue onesie, and I've got a grey onesie, and they're all fluffy, and they've all got pom-poms. And they're all impossible to have a wee in.
You know, you can get these onesies, which I do to my great shame, but I love it. I've got a onesie. It's from, I can't remember, One Piece, I think, is the name of the company. And it has a zip around the bum area.
I thought I'd invented that. I was going to patent that.
Too late. But that is because I go wild swimming. And that's so I take that. And yeah, it's quite useful. But so you might be wearing a onesie, which I'm horrified by. But you still have your pearls and you've got beautiful pearl earrings, pearl necklace, you're wearing lipstick, you've got your makeup on, you've got lovely hair. How have you managed to keep your hair that, because you're blonde, there's no grey at all, unlike me. How have you managed to do that? Is it out of a bottle?
I've inherited my father's hair, which never went grey. I didn't realise that. Until I got this age. So I did once go to Peru, where our guide told us that Incas don't go grey either, so therefore you can always tell in Peru who are the Spanish descendants because they go grey and who are the Inca descendants because they don't. So it is a little known fact that I may have Inca ancestry, but seems unlikely, doesn't it? But I cut my own hair. When I think of the years I must have spent, if you add all the time, in hairdressers. I saw my hairdresser more often than I saw any member of my family. And now I cut it myself.
You do not. Do you have it, what, with the kitchen scissors?
No, my daughter has very nice hairdressing scissors.
Okay. And you cut it yourself. How do you do the back of your hair?
By feel.
That is amazing. So you don't have to dye it and you cut your own hair. You are like a rose bush, basically, aren't you? You're all natural and you do your own pruning.
That could be that.
It's fantastic. So you went on to, you decided that after Oxford, did your parents have any aspirations for you with your, you know, for your life and / career?
Yes and no. My father... I remember when I was about six wandering around with him. I can tell you exactly where I was, actually, in Cricklewood in Northwest Two. And I said to him, what should you do with your life? Quite a big question for a six-year-old. And he said, well, I suppose the ambition should be to be educated as long as you can. And I said, how do you do that? He said, you go to university. 1946, you see.
Wow, yeah.
Female.
Yeah.
So I said, which university? So he said, well, they always used to say Oxford for arts and Cambridge for science. So I was quite clear that I was not a scientist, even at that stage. So Oxford became my dream. So that was an aspiration, and remarkable, because for many girls, if you'd asked your parents that your parents would have said, get married and have children, okay? Mm. That was not what my father said. Nor was it my mother's dream for me either. She wanted, I think she enjoyed grandchildren. I'm not sure she enjoyed son-in-laws. Because less of about her two daughters.
Mm.
But the great thing I had was parents who were always surprised by anything I did. So there were no bicycles if you get A's for this exam. There were no rewards. They were always amazed by anything I did. And usually quite pleased. Though I will say that when I went out on the streets on That's Life asking people whether they liked hard blue paper or soft blue paper, is it not extraordinary to think we ever had hard blue paper?
Oh,
terrible. Anyway, so my mother said to me, Esther, is that really necessary? My friends were quite shocked. So I reported back to my team. It's interesting in television, people very often quote their mothers, you know, because at whatever level they were, researchers or producers or whatever, they would say, my mom said.
Yeah.
And that was quite useful because, you know, you can get into an ivory tower situation and only listen to the group around you. And I watch television and I think to myself, you think that's really funny, don't you? And that's why Gogglebox is such a hit, because that actually shows program makers that Hugh Weldon was right when he said, you always have to assume in your viewer maximum intelligence, minimum information. They're going to be brighter than you are because they're relaxed and watching television and you're all tense and worried about making the program. But don't take any information for granted. Make sure you give them the facts they need to understand what you're telling them. And that was then and is now a very good rule of thumb. And Gogglebox, as I say, is bringing to the wide British public what everybody's mother is really saying on her sofa.
Yeah, it's so true. It is so true. And I think, funny enough, I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but I find, in my experience, I find it's men and boys who will, you know, say, well, my mother said, more than the girls.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Mm, mm.
No, that is true.
The wisdom of the mother.
Shows what influence we have. That's why my son cut the apron strings as soon as he could and went off to boarding school surrounded by boys and men. Winchester College, which is now considering taking girls.
Is it? Oh, my gosh. He must be extremely bright because that is like the hardest school to get into, isn't it, academically? Always has been.
My son is annoying because he never knowingly, in my experience, did any work. But I used to, when I took him to school in the morning, there was always a spelling test I had to do with him, and he infuriated me because he'd never studied it. He'd never read the books, but he always knew how to spell it. Great bluffer, my son. Anyway, he's now a junior doctor, so he's not bluffing anymore, I'm sure.
Yeah. So what was your first television role? What was your first job? Did you start as a secretary? Did you start as a researcher? Studio manager. What was your first entry into TV?
Well, I started as a clerk, which is below secretarial.
Okay.
Didn't have the skills of a secretary.
So you went from Oxford to being a lowly, below-level secretary.
I went from Oxford to being a sound effects assistant. We were called studio managers in the radio. And I did that for 2.5 years. And then resigned from that because I realised that anything creative I'd ever done, and when I was applying for jobs, on my CV, it was all stuff I'd done at university, nothing I'd done since. And so I was getting less and less employable, so I thought, this isn't working. So I resigned and did something I should have done way earlier and always recommend to young friends, and that is I pulled a string. Because there was somebody who was at university with me and had worked with me on some of the productions I did, whose mother was rather senior in the BBC. And the thing is that judging people on a form, application form, or in interview, You learn nothing, really, except whether somebody's good at interviews, can assemble enough lies for that application form. But if you got a recommendation from someone who has worked alongside you, it means something. So my friend's name was John Spicer, and his mother's name was Joanna Spicer. Don't ask me about anything that happened this week. I like your dog.
Oh, I've got two of them. Shush! Sorry, Esther.
It's all right. My experience is that there are always more entertaining moments than when people are talking. But still, what kind of dogs?
We have a Parsons Jack Russell, who's adorable, little bitch. And then we have an Italian greyhound called Rocco, who is an absolute moron. He's got one brain cell, but he's hilarious. And we had no idea why. You know, we didn't know anything about Italian greyhounds, but he was born at the right time and close by, so we now have Rocco.
What's the difference between an Italian greyhound and a British greyhound?
Italian greyhounds, they're actually a very ancient breed. So if you think of those portraits of the Medici's Renaissance paintings, they are always holding a little whippet-like dog, and that's an Italian greyhound. So they're like whippets, but they've got shorter legs and they're a lot uglier.
Oh,
basically.
Oh, that's useful to know. Thank you.
So now you know, but they are very funny. So in 1968, you began a love affair with your department head, Desmond Wilcox, who you later married. And is that right?
I don't know. Possibly. Carry on.
And you were married for 23 years. And I don't know my husband, I could walk into the room wearing a bin liner and he wouldn't even notice. How was Desmond with your clothing choices and the way you dressed? Did he have any influence?
No, he dressed very well himself.
Yeah.
And when I first met him, it was the era of the kipper tie, and he had the most amazing kipper ties. They were enormous and beautiful. I remember we went on holiday together and he was dressed in lilac denim from head to foot, including a matching hat. And as we walked down a pier in the west of Ireland, someone walking the other way said, "Oh God, no, not here." Anyway, so, but then when we went on holiday to Greece and he was wearing a flowing kaftan, the waiter said, paid no attention to me, and said, "Oh sir, you are so beautiful." But then Plato was a bit like that, wasn't he? Anyway, he had a great eye for a strong sartorial sense, and he was very good on the clothes I should wear. He always liked my legs. Mm-hmm. He was a leg man, and he always liked my legs. And he always objected if I wore a skirt of any length covering up. And said his view was that I looked like a New Zealand schoolmistress. I mean, no offence to New Zealand schoolmistresses.
How do you identify a New Zealand schoolmistress?
Bit prim, I think he thought. And unmetropolitan, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
They normally had flowers or dots on them and had long, swirly skirts. I liked them, he didn't. But I'm sure he liked New Zealand school teachers when he met them, but he just didn't necessarily think their clothes suited me.
That's it for part one. If you enjoyed it, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on your chosen podcast platform. Thanks to Esther, to our house band duo, and of course, thanks to you for listening. Catch up soon. Until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.